Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Los Angeles, where tonight I'll be in Santa Monica at 7:30 at the Barnes & Noble on the 3rd Street, 3rd Street Promenade. There you go, in Santa Monica. Our quote for the day, from Susan B. Anthony. Independence is happiness. Failure is impossible. There will never be complete equality until women themselves help to make laws and elect lawmakers. I declare to you that women must not depend upon the protection of men, but must be taught to protect themselves, and there I take my stand. Susan B. Anthony, back in the 1870s. Women's suffrage over time. John Lott Jr. writing about this in the Washington Times. And what makes this perhaps a little less than just an oddity is two things. One, the very real possibility of a woman running for president in the form of Senator Hillary Clinton. And the other is this quote from Ann Coulter back on October 2nd. She said, if we took away a woman's right to vote, we'd never have to worry about another Democratic president. It's kind of a pipe dream. It's a personal fantasy of mine, but I don't think it's going to happen. Ann Coulter. John Lott Jr. with us. John is an economist. He's the author of Freedomnomics, sort of the conservative answer to Freakonomics, Why the Free Market Works and Other Half-Baked Theories Don't. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Good to be on and talk to you again.
John, you've written an article basically, well, rather than my stating your premise, why don't you state your premise?
Well, there's been a big debate among academics for a long time about why governments in the United States and around the world started to grow when they did. When you look in the United States, the federal government was about the same size from the beginning of the country up until the end of World War One. It would be about 2 to 3% of GNP. You'd have a war, it would go up, and then it would come down after the war. World War One was basically the first time that didn't go back down again, and then it basically started to grow. People think that you had big changes during the Depression, but really that was just a continuation of the growth rates in government that had started a decade earlier.
And you pretty right much around 1920.
Right. And you look around the world, and there's a 50-year period of time around the world where different countries in different years would start to grow, even though their governments had pretty much been about the same size for hundreds of years. And I kind of was looking around one day, and I noticed that these growth rates started immediately after these different countries gave women the right to vote. And the same thing happened when you look at individual states. The first state to give women the right to vote was in 1868. And then you had other states doing it up until 1920, when the 19th Amendment to the Constitution brought all the rest of the states in line.
Right. And my take of your take on this, the way that this article is written in the Washington Times, is that you think that that growth of government is essentially a bad thing.
No, I don't think so. I mean, this is basically, I have a much bigger, longer discussion in my book, Freedomnomics, but I'll just tell you, this is probably about the only thing in the world that I think Ann Coulter and Catherine MacKinnon, I don't know if she had the office next door to me when I was at the University of Chicago, very well-known feminist legal scholar, agreed on in terms of the impact of women on the sides of government. They had quite different takes on what should be done about it, obviously.
Right.
But Catherine, when she had the office next door, she thought the research that I'd done was great because it basically confirmed her view that men weren't doing a good job representing the viewpoints of women and how important it was that women should be able to vote.
Right, and representing the viewpoints of really many of us or all of us. The point you make in your article is that women being more inclined to be nurturers, essentially, to be caring, and men more inclined to be, I guess, you know, strutting posers or something, you know, more concerned about, Claudius, I'm a great warrior. Kind of thing, that women would take government in the direction of the nurturant family, to use George Lakoff's model, whereas if women were not allowed to participate in government, you'd have government that is, you know, very kind of Ron Paul libertarian. It would simply be the army and the police force.
Right. Well, I think, a lot of this
I'd say this is a great thing that women are participating in our governance.
So you agree with Catherine McKinnon?
I do. In fact, I think we need more of it.
Right, but it's really dramatic, the impact. If you were to graph out kind of the government expenditures and revenue for states in, let's say, the 10 years before they give women the right to vote, it's fairly flat in state after state. And then as soon as women are given the right to vote, it starts to go up the next year. And within 10 years, on average, it's more than doubled in real per capita terms. I mean,
yes.
It's really
dramatic.
So here's,
you know, you're looking at this from one direction. Let's turn the telescope around in the other direction and look at it and say, look at how bizarre government was. I mean, government was actually, you know, you go back and you read the preamble to the Constitution. There are six specific things that our government was created to do. And all but defense have to do with basically, you know, the protecting the general welfare and you know, nurturant things that government should have been doing all these years. And you know, when Ben Franklin introduced in the first day of the Constitutional Convention in 1786 in Philadelphia, there was 34 members of the Iroquois Confederacy there, and he made this speech where he said, you know, it would be a I'm paraphrasing badly from memory here, but words to the effect of if five nations of ignorant savages, that was a phrase he used, you know, it didn't sound so bad back then as it does now. If five nations of ignorant savages have been able to forge a union which has survived in peace for 1,000 years, then certainly 13 colonies of educated Englishmen can do the same. And among the Iroquois Confederacy, of those five nations, four of them did not allow men to vote. Only women could vote. And their societies worked quite well, thank you very much, and were very you know, very peaceful. In fact, they used games to settle disputes rather than warfare. They invented lacrosse as a way of resolving disputes. And so what you could say is, because the founders of this country said, hey, gee, only one gender voting, that's a great idea, but let's pick men instead of women. Because they did that for the better part of 150 years, you know, from the founding of this country until 1920, we had a bizarre form of government
that didn't
do the things that the founders originally envisioned and the government should do in a democracy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I view it as more each group has their own selfish interests, to, you know, whether it's men or whether it's women. So, for example, if you look at women's views and how they vote, it changes fairly dramatically over their lifetime. Men, for better or worse, are pretty much stuck in the mud in terms of how they vote over their whole lives. But women, when they're young and single, they tend to be much more liberal than men. When they get married, about half of that gap disappears, with women becoming more conservative. When they get married with kids, they become even more conservative, for about 75% of the gap closes then. But when they get divorced with kids, they become much more liberal than they started off to begin with.
Now, what do you mean by conservative and liberal?
Well, I mean, if you look at, for example, do they support higher income taxes? Do they support more progressive taxes?
Do they support things like national health care and payment for education?
Right, yeah, a whole
like
range
that.
Of social
so that's,
programs.
That's your spectrum.
And if you look at, how they vote on supporting more taxes, it's basically whether they're married or not, whether they're married, because men have higher incomes, more variable, more likely to be hit by the higher, more progressive tax rates. And when they're married and married to a guy who's going to be bearing more of those taxes, they're against those taxes. When they're single, then they're much more in favor of those types of taxes.
Yeah, so it could be that they're simply acquiring the values of their husbands. John, we're talking with John Lott, Jr., this article he wrote for the Washington Times, Woman's Suffrage Over Time, and he's an economist and the author of Freedomnomics, Why the Free Market Works. Freedomnomics, right. Why the Free Market Works and Other Half-Baked Theories Don't. John, do you know of any Republicans who are taking your information and running with it and saying, okay, we've got to stop women from voting now? I mean, the Republican Party for a long time, going back to Nixon, has been working pretty aggressively to stop, for example, African-Americans from voting. And Native Americans from voting. I mean, Justice Rehnquist was famous for, perhaps infamous, for his efforts on behalf of the Arizona Republican Party back in the 1950s of intimidating Native Americans, preventing them from going to the polls. You know, there's kind of a long history. And the Democratic Party used to do the same back in the 20s and 30s and 40s when they were the racist party. Do you see the Republican Party taking this information and running with it and saying, we've got to figure out a way to stop women from voting?
Well, first of all, I don't think you're really serious about claiming that Republicans don't want African-Americans to vote. But
I'm quite serious.
I think there is something to take from this. If you're a Republican, we didn't get into this, but you could actually make divorce more difficult, and that would make women more conservative, and I could explain why that would be.
Interesting.
Case.
Interesting. So let's make it against the law to get a divorce.
No.
John Lott Jr. of WashingtonTimes.com. Freedomnomics, the book. Thanks, John.
Okay.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you live in Los Angeles today, broadcasting from the studios of KTALK, KTLK, our Los Angeles affiliate. Well, it's an interesting and novel theory. I guess Ann Coulter might have been right. I mean, she if this guy's stats and research are right, and there is some sense associated with it. In fact, that if women had never given been given the right to vote, we would continue to see nothing but Republican victories. And there is, I think, a sense. I remember, you know, doing the CPAC conference last year, and it was just all, you know, male white guys. I mean, basically, it's just the party of WASP power or something. I don't know how to say it, but interesting. And so our and his assertion that the Republican Party is not now trying to suppress African American voters. I mean, that's crazy. Look at what happened in Ohio in the 2004 election. Look at what happened in Florida in the 2000 election. Look at what has happened on Native American reservations around the country for, you know, a century. Not just the Republican Party, as I said, the Democratic Party. When Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in, as I recall, 1967, he basically handed the racist vote, which had been the property of the Democratic Party up until that point. The Democratic Party, you know, the oldest and longest serving political party in American history, had you know, going into the Civil War, had been the party of slavery. And after the Civil War had been a party that, to a large extent, although it was the party of labor, and it was, I mean, there were some good, many good things about the Democratic Party. It was also the party of the racists, at least in the South, and particularly in the South. And Lyndon Johnson blew off the racists in the South by signing that civil rights legislation. And Richard Nixon said, ha-ha, we got a Southern strategy here, my friends, and was off to the races. The, you know, bad pun, but whatever. And so, anyhow, saw the Republican debate last night, caught it from the airport here in Los Angeles, just got off the plane just as the thing was starting. And for me, the high point in the whole thing was that deer in headlights moment for Anderson Cooper when Campbell Brown said, Anderson, why wasn't anybody asked questions about, you know, the big issues of the day? And she went through a list. I don't remember exactly what the list was, but it was something like health care, the environment, global warming, stuff like that. And he had this, and he said, well, maybe next time. Yeah. And in today's USA Today, a study from, as I recall, from the front page, one quarter of U.S. bird species at risk. Almost all of Hawaii's non-migratory native birds are on a new watch list. The list released Wednesday by the National Audubon Society and American Bird Conservancy includes more than one quarter of the more than 700 species that breed in the U.S., a quarter of all birds in America. And a you know, a massive number of them in Hawaii, but this is, you know, right across the country, right across the country. And he Greg Butcher is the you know, tragically named co-author of the Audubon Society report, and he said people and birds share a need for clean water, for clean air, and for natural habitat. As we see, bird populations are out of kilter. There's a sense the entire environment is out of kilter. Not much discussed about that last night in the Republican debates. Instead, you had Mitt Romney saying, well, if he becomes president and he's got to make the decision of whether or not waterboarding is torture, he's going to ask Kofor Black, the number two guy over Blackwater, whether it's torture or not. This is the same Kofor Black. In fact, this is an exact quote from him last night. He said, I get that advice from Kofor Black, who's a person who was responsible for counterterrorism in the CIA for some 35 years. Yeah, Kofor Black, here's a quote from Kofor Black, speaking of, you know, what we're going to do when we go into Afghanistan. He's the guy who said to capture bin Laden, kill him, and bring his head back in a box on dry ice. He wants the heads of the terrorists in Afghanistan on sticks. He says, we're going to kill them. This is Kofor Black. We're going to put their heads on sticks. And when we're through with them, they will have flies walking across their eyeballs. This is the guy. See, this is a strong argument for us picking up what the Iroquois Confederacy figured out was very wise. They had written into their constitution that every decision made had to be made in the context of its impact on the seventh generation, and that there was only one group among us that was really concerned about the seventh generation, and that was the women. Maybe we should consider disenfranchising men in the United States, doing away with the male vote. Would it become a better country, a more compassionate country? I think, frankly, it probably would. It certainly seemed to work well for the Iroquois Confederacy for a long, long time. But that ain't going to happen. I mean, it's the dream on or fantasize on or whatever. Really, what we need to do is we need to get as many people voting as possible. We need to get as many people participating as possible. And unfortunately, I'm not sure how to make that happen. Australia has an over 90% participation rate in their elections, which is a fine thing. The way they do it, though, is you get hit with a $25 fine if you don't vote, and it escalates over time if you continue to not vote, and they just, you know, they add it to your tax bill, as I recall. Maybe we should be considering something like that. I don't know if that would be constitutional or not, but it seems like a good idea. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Here's another way to frame the why did government grow argument, though. And it's an interesting one. One of the folks in the chat room actually pointed this out to me. And that is that population has been exploding since 1920. Think about it for a minute. It took all of human history to create the first 1 billion people. We were at the time of Christ about a quarter of a billion, 250 million people. By the year 1000, we were at a half a billion. I mean, population was growing rapidly, but not, you know, on geologic time scales, it was growing rapidly, but it didn't. Anyhow, it took 165,000 years of human history to reach 1 billion people in the year 1800. The second billion only took 100 years, 1930. Okay, so his research shows the government started really growing around 1920. Well, that would be just as we were hitting our second billion worldwide. And U.S. population was following these trends, by the way. Our third billion didn't take 165,000 years, didn't take 130 years. Our third billion people took only 30 years. By 1960, we had 3 billion people in the world. The year John Kennedy was sworn into office, 3 billion people. World population had pretty much doubled over it was at the time of the Civil War. The fourth billion people didn't even take 30 years. It only took 14 years, 1960, 1974. The fifth billion people only took 13 years, 1987. And the sixth billion people only took 11 years, 1999. And we're now working on our seventh billion people. So as population grows, you would expect government to grow because government has to provide the infrastructure, the services necessary for the population. So that's another possible explanation, although I suppose that wouldn't account for government as a percentage of GDP as opposed to government in absolute numbers. Interesting theory. Kitty in Queens, New York. Hey, Kitty, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I have another take on the statistics from your last interview.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the women became more conservative when they got married because women are kind of taught to follow their husbands, and if the men are more conservative, that's what they did when they got married. And when they got divorced and got rid of those guys, they went again to their own beliefs.
Yeah, well, that was my point, that maybe they were being influenced by their husband's perspective.
Right.
And
plus the fact, I believe, I was doing some internet searching here, looks like married men are more liberal than single men, which probably means that they look after their children more. Because
right.
when you're a single man, you don't tend to care much about children.
Right. And that's the great conservative myth, is that, you know, we're a nation of Davy Crockett's, and every guy wants to be Davy Crockett. And,
right.
And, you know, to carve a new life out of the American wilderness. And the reality is that, the Davy Crockett's of the world, A, carved a new life out of the American Indian rather than the American wilderness. I mean, you know, well, no, I'm serious. I mean, it was stealing other people's lands and resources.
No, I know exactly what you mean. I was a history major in college. And
yeah.
I understand all that stuff. We really did a job on them.
Right. And to say that, we're just a bunch of independent folks, you know, who know how to just make it on our own. I mean, you know, it's the old Joe Republican thing, John Gray's brilliant Joe Republican thing about, you know, Joe Republican, you know, drinking his fresh water in the morning that's pure because the government, you know,
yes,
some liberals and all that kind of stuff.
I wish you would put that statement on your website because I'd like to copy it and send it to my cousin who's lost his mind.
I will do so, Kitty. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate
Thank you.
I appreciate you calling in. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Rich, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. You know, it doesn't surprise me, your last guest. You know, much like the Taliban would like to take us all back to the 7th century, the Republicans would like to take us all back to the cold conformity of the 1950s.
Or maybe the 19-teens before women had the right to vote in 1920.
And that's possible, too. You know, probably the single greatest thing we as human beings can do to address the most of the world's problems is to educate women and get them politically active, you know, teen pregnancy, sexually transmitted diseases, reduce poverty. And unfortunately, I think one of the great flaws of our country, which I love, is that I think that we live in a culture that fears strong, independent women. You know, we want them to be simple, pretty things. And I think as brothers and fathers and sons, the best thing we can do is encourage the women in our lives to become educated, strong, independent women.
And you're welcome. Thank you, Rich. And provide the space for it. You know, just provide the space for it is an important one. Doug in San Diego, California. You want to take me to task here, Doug?
Yes, sir. Mr. Hartman, your integrity level will be a lot higher with conservatives, Republicans, if you actually get the quotes right. First, Republicans don't want non-citizens and felons to vote.
They also don't want African-Americans to vote. That's why the Republican Party has been doing...
That's not true.
Do you realize, Doug, that the Republican Party has for over 20 years had a court order against them for caging operations against African-Americans? Are you aware of that?
Get back to the issue with non-citizens. Don't change it to African-Americans.
I never established the issue as non-citizens. You did.
Citizens, you know that Democrats want non-citizens to vote. They do it in Oregon.
No, they don't.
They do it in California. Yes, they don't prosecute them. The numbers are just dismal. And if you can't know those numbers, if you can't find out the numbers in California,
non-citizens are not voting, Doug. That's a hysterical red herring.
No, it's not.
The people who are telling you that are trying to get you all panicked and terrified, and apparently it's succeeded.
No, it's
you sound like a fearful little guy.
No, because New York allows non-citizens to vote, California allows it, and Oregon allows it.
No state allows non-citizens to vote, Doug. No state allows non-citizens to vote, and somebody whose immigration status is illegal and they know it. You think that they're going to show up at a government function and say, "Hi, here I am"?
Yes, because they don't get prosecuted. Can
no.
I give you the numbers real quick in California? Because I did the research on this.
You did.
From 1994 to 2004, according to the Secretary of State, Bruce McPherson, who's no longer the Secretary of State, it's Deborah Bowen. But those numbers were only 163 cases went up for prosecution for individuals. Only two were prosecuted. With
right.
group cases, there were groups trying to register people to vote. There were 600 cases that went up, and only 22 were prosecuted.
Okay, so that's the entire state of California, which is probably about six times the size of the state of Florida. And in Florida, in 2000, you had 80,000 African-Americans who were legal voters who, when they showed up at the polls, were turned away because of a Republican caging operation, which was a violation of a 20-year-old court order against the Republican Party from doing caging. Caging is where they send out letters to people, and if those people don't respond to the letters, then they at the polls, they challenge their vote, and they force them to vote on a provisional ballot, which usually doesn't get counted on election night. And
okay, I don't support that. Neither do Republicans. Nobody's going to say that they're going to.
The Republicans are aggressively supporting that. They did
no,
the same
don't.
Thing in Ohio in 2000.
You're changing the subject to non-citizens.
In 2004.
Immigrants vote Democrat.
So you're saying that because two people were successfully prosecuted for being non-citizens and voting, that we have a crisis?
Because they're not checking the voting poll. They're letting anybody register. You can go online and register. Online and register. They're not checking your citizenship. They're not checking. You know,
Doug, I'm just not getting it. You know, it's
how can you not get that they don't check their citizenship?
No, what I'm not getting is why somebody who is here illegally would want to put themselves at risk of
because
showing up at a government polling station.
They don't get prosecuted, Mr. Hartman. No one's prosecuting them.
Why would they even be voting for that?
Have you ever been to DMV or to traffic court?
Sure.
Okay,
I haven't been to
traffic court.
I've never committed an offense.
Okay, did you notice that traffic court, here in California especially, that they show up and they don't have a driver's license, they don't have registration, don't have a social security card, obviously you're illegal.
Then why are they showing up?
They have enough call to stand before a judge because the judge knows that they're just going to let them go because they're not going to ask about their immigration status. That's why they're not being prosecuted,
pure and simple. Doug, that's another and larger issue, and that is, you know, what are we going to do as a nation about people who are here without documentation, people who are here illegally?
Oh, you know what you do?
And,
it's really simple. It's called a Z visa. The Z visa is 5 years, five years in prison. You got a report. You get $500 fine. You go back in 5 years. And if you don't go back in 5 years, it's 5 years in prison. Pretty simple.
Yeah. A much simpler way, Doug, would be to simply say, there's no jobs for you here.
That's also true.
Do you really think anybody's going to stick around if there's no job for them?
With blacks voting. No Republican is going to say that they don't want blacks to vote. That's just not true.
No Republican's going to say it out loud, Doug, but it is what Republicans are doing. It's what they're doing
aggressively. I'm not doing it. I'm a Republican.
State by state. No, the Republican Party. The Republican Party, people within the Tim Cummings. Here you had Karl Rove's number two guy. Maybe you didn't hear Sarah Taylor's testimony before Congress, where she said that Karl Rove's number two guy, the guy who then became the federal judge or federal prosecutor down in Alabama, as I recall, or maybe it was Louisiana, was in charge of the caging operation that Karl Rove was running out of the White House. And what was so astounding to me was that several Democratic members of Congress were like, what's caging? They didn't know what this was. They didn't realize that for over 20 years, the Republican Party has been operating with a restraining order against them to prevent them from doing just this, disenfranchising African Americans. There is massive election fraud going on in the United States, and there has been for a long, long time. Frankly, it goes all the way back to the founding of this country, ballot box stuffing and disenfranchisement of people. And it's being conducted in large part by the Republican Party over the last 20 years or so. There might be some small amount of voter fraud, as you're pointing out, and you know, yeah, two people
no,
prosecuted in California.
It's very large, and do the numbers and do the investigation. You'll find out. Then report it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll look around, Doug. I'll look around. Thanks a lot for the call. I'm just far more concerned, frankly, with the political party engaging in election fraud. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Tonight I will be at Barnes & Noble in Santa Monica on the 3rd Street Promenade. Or is it Promenade? I'm not sure how you say that. Anyhow, that's where it is in Santa Monica, 7:30. We'll be giving a riff and signing Cracking the Code. And tomorrow night, Oak Park, California, the Ventura County Democrats Speaker Series, 7 to 9 p.m. And then on December 14th, I'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota at 7 p.m. at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at Kauffman Memorial Union. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Marty in Los Angeles. Hey, Marty. Welcome.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi, Tom.
Good to be in your fair city, I have to say.
Yeah, I wanted to refute what your last caller was saying. I have worked personally and directly for a number of years on a daily basis with many undocumented people, and voter fraud is the last thing, you know, on that these people would, you know, they'd be afraid, as you, the point you were making, of even going to an official polling place. The numbers must be infinitesimally small.
Right.
I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it is completely, from my personal experience, completely untrue what the last caller was saying. You know, I don't know where he got his statistics from, but it just is, as a matter of fact, from my own personal experience, tells me it's just simply untrue.
Yeah,
what he was saying.
I absolutely agree with you, Marty. And John Fish, who's driving me around here in Los Angeles today, a friend and a fellow who hangs out in our chat room a lot and participates with the show, he was just, during the break we were talking, and he said, I live in Los Angeles. He says, I don't know what he's talking about. He says, you know, every time I vote, you see the same people's names, you recognize their names, you recognize their addresses. You know, it's a community thing. I mean, we vote on a fairly local basis here. These local precincts, and you know, if all of a sudden a whole bunch of quote illegal immigrants showed up, they'd stand out like a sore thumb. I mean, you know, who are these folks, and where do they? You know, the community doesn't know them. We don't know. So, you know, it's just, you know, I'm not buying it. But see, the problem is that the fear, and this all is part of this larger kind of, well, not kind of, this larger racist thing of, oh, look out, the brown people are coming. You know, this fear of these folks is being peddled to, frankly, terrified white guys who are mostly terrified of losing their jobs and not being able to provide for their families because the conservatives have ripped apart the social fabric of this country over the last 30 years. And you know, out of their fear, it's very easy to redirect that fear into racism, and that's what's happening here. And I think it's
a
tragedy.
I agree with you completely.
It's just a tragedy. Marty, thanks a lot for the call. Desmond in Brooklyn, New York. Let's flip over to the other side of the country. Hey, Desmond.
Hi, Tom. Good morning. I agree. I'm calling on the same subject. Doug, the caller who said that all these issues about immigrants coming here and trying to commit voter fraud.
Right.
I just wanted to cite the fact that if you go back to Elian Gonzalez and what was happening in Florida at that time, it was obvious that there was a pressure to allow Cuban immigrants, white Hispanics, to come into the country while stopping Haitian immigrants and detaining them and sending them back. And the logic that was given out then was the fact that people of African descent would tend towards voting democratically, and white Hispanics would tend toward voting Republican. And so the Republican administration at that time skewed towards allowing white Hispanics in, saying that they were viable, that there were jobs, and that they were going to be a credit to the economy and to the infrastructure, and that the Haitians would be destabilizing because of their socioeconomic and language problems.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and in fact, the Cuban community in Miami does largely, or at least used to. I haven't, you know, checked recently, but I, you know, certainly in the 60s and 70s and 80s was kind of notorious for being a very Republican, very conservative community. What the basis of that is, you know, is anybody's guess. It may have as much to do with anti-Castroism as anything else. But we discount racism in this country at our own peril. You know, it's just that's the bottom line.
Racism is a constant factor, and it's a xenophobic fear. And you just touched on it when you were speaking to the last caller. White males, in particular, are afraid of losing their sense of entitlement, and the white females see them basically as being their protectors, and they tend to more or less buy into that. Now, that's not.
Yeah.
It's not that they're
afraid of their sense of entitlement, Desmond. It's that they're afraid of the. It's almost a demasculinization thing. It's they're afraid of losing their ability to provide for their family.
Exactly.
And in this culture, they have been trained to believe that is how you determine how male you are, how virile you are, is your competence to do this. And that's why we put these alpha dogs like Donald Trump on TV. You know, oh, he's a rich guy. He must be very, you know, it's a, and all that kind of thing. Desmond, I got to move along to another call here. We've got to wrap up, but thanks for the call. I appreciate
it. You're welcome.
Craig in Iowa. Hey, Craig.
Hi, you're a guest. I wonder if you thought it'd be okay if only married women would vote. The Republican Party could push that, and single, as soon as you divorce or single, you cannot vote anymore.
Yeah. The Republicans will parse this, and as I said, this is, you know, the Democrats used to do this, but the Republicans will parse it and cut it down. I don't have my machine with me where I can play the clips, but I have that famous clip of one of the leading Republican spinmeisters, as it were, saying that, you know, we don't want people to vote, that the Republican Party is all about suppressing the vote, and then that's their number one challenge. So anyway, Steve in Charleston, West Virginia, just a few seconds here. Steve, quick comment.
Yeah, I'm against you. I want fewer people to vote, and that was like pretty good timing with what you just said about Republicans. If I have a chance to explain.
Well, I think we're out of time on this hour, Steve, but maybe we can pick it up a little later on in the show. You just like the smarter people to vote, right? I mean, that was Alexander Hamilton's idea. Let's have a meritocracy. That doesn't work. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. Let's talk electoral politics here for a little while. There are primaries coming up. There's a lot going on. We had the Republican debate last night. That was interesting to watch. You see these guys basically not dealing in a substantive way with any issues other than Ron Paul. I mean, Ron Paul taking the things on. They're not debates. I mean, let's just be honest about it. They're not debates. They are serial soundbite opportunities where topics are presented. But the topics last night were not particularly deep. Paul Loeb is on the line with us, an old friend of mine and the author of The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear, named the number 3 political book of 2004 by the History Channel, and a whole bunch of other books. Paul, L-O-E-B, theimpossible.org is his website. And Paul's, I recommend any of Paul's books to you. Paul, great to have you on the program.
Hey, it's always fun.
Thank you. You wrote a piece that appeared first, I think, on the Huffington Post and then migrated all over the web earlier in the week or late last week, in which you were talking about the possibility that Hillary Clinton, if she's elected in the Democratic primaries as the nominee for the Democratic Party, may cause some harm to the Democratic Party. Let's talk about this and some of the other candidates as well. And I'd also like to get your impressions of last night's Republican debate.
It's interesting. The piece did indeed migrate. I think it has something like 1,500 comments out there. I mean, it's just people. There are like 350 people like arguing with each other on Huffington Post and 800 at the Daily Kos, and they're just. It really seemed to draw a nerve.
Yeah.
And basically, a lot of people have raised the issue, and I think rightly so, of whether or not Hillary, in fact, is electable in the general election. Because she's sort of running on, you know, this is the pragmatic candidate, and you can put your ideals aside and your naivete, but this is realism. But as that latest Zogby poll suggests, actually, she may lose to the Republicans, even though both Obama and Edwards do better than she does and beat them by, not huge margins, but in the same poll, they did about 4 or 5 points better.
But there's a huge caveat, Paul. I mean, that Zogby poll, first of all, was a Zogby online poll, so it's going to be skewed toward younger voters.
That's true.
It doesn't represent the actual populace. And there are several polls out by other reputable polling organizations that are done by more traditional methods, which may actually miss younger voters because
right.
a lot of younger voters just have cell phones and,
exactly.
and therefore they never get
yeah.
polled.
Yeah.
But telephone polls that show that Hillary is handily beating any of the Republican candidates.
Yeah. So
I think we need to take that with a grain of salt. What I find interesting about it, though, is that the mainstream media has reported very heavily on this Zogby poll, and they haven't reported on the other polls that were released at the same time by other polling agencies that showed that Hillary could defeat these candidates.
Yeah, I suppose that is true, but I guess what to me is it does put a kind of raise a vulnerability. And the vulnerability that I see, it's really twofold. And this is sort of underscored by the responses to the piece, which is you get a very large number of people, and you know, it's hard to measure because people are clicking on the web, but it's extremely passionate voices saying, I would vote for any of the Democrats, but not Hillary. And so these are essentially people in the core base. And, of course, by the time an election comes around, they may change their mind. But what it suggests is that there's a really significant resistance among a decent section of the Democratic base, given her policies and what she stands for.
And this has nothing to do with her being a woman. This has
no, it has absolutely nothing, because these are people who, if anything, would much prefer, they'd love a woman candidate. It has to
right.
do with her stand on Iraq. It has to do with the Kyle Lieberman vote on Iran that she supported. It has to do with the trade policies. It has to do with the tax bill. It has to do with all the ways that she is essentially a somewhat regressive candidate, although I would say better than these ghastly Republicans. But what's interesting is that's one set of issues. But the second set that nobody has talked about until I wrote this piece called Hillary and the Politics of Disappointment is what happens if she does get in. And I went back to basically Bill Clinton's presidency.
By get in, you mean as the Democratic nominee?
Well, and not only as the Democratic nominee, but also prevails in the election.
What if she becomes president?
What if she becomes president? And one of the things that nobody has talked about is the way that Bill Clinton split the party. And it really came home to me. Yeah, I remember in 1992, I was down canvassing a swing suburban edge district about 25 miles from Seattle. And there were something like 8 volunteers. And every precinct in Washington State that was remotely Democratic had that level of volunteers. It was this huge enthusiastic participation, and we swept all but one congressional seat and a governor and a senator and presidents, and it was sort of as good as you can get if you wanted to be able to shift the balance of power from the Reagan-Bush years. And then what happened, in the next 2 years, you saw a lot of things going on, but NAFTA in particular, and you saw Democrats demoralized. And I remember there was about a year later, there was a regressive tax initiative, and you couldn't get people to turn out to fight it in the most liberal districts in Seattle. I mean, there were no volunteers. Same thing on the day of the election in 2004. And then throughout that season, I was traveling around. I'd done a book called Generation of the Crossroads on students and their values. And I was going, I think I hit 11 or 12 states that fall. And there were key races everywhere. And the people that I was staying with, hanging out with, were longtime political activists. And they were not engaged. They were just so angry and so frustrated at Clinton, because particularly of NAFTA. And this was all before the Monica scandal surfaced. She was still a college student in Oregon at that point, had never met Bill yet. And they were so frustrated that they simply stayed home. And it's not so much that their votes, because most of them did vote, but what they didn't do that they had 2 years previously is volunteer. And these were people who were good, energetic, skilled, experienced. And from the surveys that were done afterwards, had the turnouts been higher, most of that Gingrich rout would have been prevented or reversed, and the Democrats might have hung on to the Congress. So what you saw is the key role, not just of who's voting, but also who's enthusiastically volunteering. And so, again, it comes into play in two different ways. It comes into play, you know, if Hillary is nominated, it comes into play in the 2008 election, because you have a whole lot of people who are going to be extremely reluctant and hesitating in their volunteering because they have so many qualms about her. But then if she does get in, you then have the problem of potentially splitting the party and ending up with a sort of repeat in some level of the 1994, quote, Gingrich Revolution, or whatever one called it. And so right at the point that essentially the Republicans have destroyed themselves to a certain degree with all the Bush disasters, and you have a chance for a political shift, which was the beginnings of which were manifested in 06, then you have the one candidate who's most likely in a lot of ways to just damp that shift and reverse it. And that seems to me a tremendously important point to talk about, because it's a question of the long-term political direction of the country, larger even than a single election. Although,
well, it's the long-term direction of the Democratic Party. Really.
Well, that's also true. But I think
and of activists in general. I mean, that's the kind of thing that promotes the candidacy of third-party candidates. I mean, that causes people to leave the Democratic Party and go with the Greens or go with an independent of some sort.
Oh, it absolutely does. And if I looked at these comments on the web posts, what I see are people saying, if she is the nominee, I am voting Green. I am staying home. I am voting for Ron Paul, whatever it is. It splits it. And essentially, given that we don't have a parliamentary system, if you split the Democratic Party that severely,
you end up with the Republicans.
You end up with Republicans. Yeah.
Do you see any of the other Democratic at the other Democratic candidates, and I think that, you know, maybe Joe Biden would be perceived as, to some extent, kind of an establishment candidate.
Right.
And he was wrong on the bankruptcy bill, for example. But he's, you know, from a state that has a lot of credit card industry in it. But, you know, Chris Dodd is certainly pretty progressive. Barack Obama is relatively progressive. John Edwards is very progressive. Dennis Kucinich, obviously the most progressive of the bunch. If this person becomes the candidate, the base will get disappointed and it'll demoralize the party. That's your essential argument.
Right.
Is that true of anybody other than Hillary Clinton?
I don't think it is, actually. I mean, I would say that any of the other candidates will not, and we're leaving aside the whole way that she sort of inflames the Republicans, which is another issue. But I would say that anybody other than Hillary would be much closer, of all the candidates running, would be much closer to the base. And won't split. I mean, obviously, there's compromises. People get angry at compromises. There's disagreements. But the fundamental cleavage is there with Hillary, and it's not there with the others.
Do you think we can push her to the left?
I think we can push her to the left somewhat. I mean, if she gets in, that's what I'll work to do.
Yeah.
But I just think, why allow that to happen? Why not try and actually bring somebody who can unify the party in a time we're in this huge, deep hole?
Yeah,
of the country.
Like one of the other candidates. Interesting. Paul Loeb, theimpossible.org. Thanks, Paul.
My pleasure.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Curious about your attitude about the Republican debate last night. It's you know, what really struck me was the lack of questions of substance. And the way that, well, for example, when the guy asked, you know, as a Christian conservative, how do you feel about the death penalty? Who would Jesus execute? And Mike Huckabee said, Jesus had the good sense not to run for political office. And everybody laughed. And that's been, you know, this morning I tuned on CNN before I left the hotel just to see what's going on in the world. And they were playing that clip as if it was some great victory by Huckabee, that he made this joke and everybody laughed and applauded, when in fact he never answered the question. I mean, he never even addressed the issue. And Jesus didn't run for political office. Well, then maybe you should stop talking about Jesus while you're running for political office. I mean, that's certainly one way to direct that. It was just a totally weird evening. Anyhow, 1-866-303-2270. Amy in Rockville, Maryland. Hey, Amy, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Yeah. I was just amazed. One of the things I was amazed about in the debate was that they didn't mention Mitt Romney's alleged comment that he wouldn't hire Muslims in his cabinet.
Right.
Because they're too small of a percentage of the population.
Yeah, somebody that certainly is. You know, I mean, given that Mormons are only 2% of the population, and that certainly is you would think it would be a fair game question. I wonder to what extent the filtering process at CNN had to do with, okay, first of all, we need a video that's entertaining and makes good television.
Right.
And then once we filtered out all the ones that are entertaining and make good television, then we need one that asks a question that is, you know, within the acceptable bounds of questions. And that they might have filtered out so many that they, you know, and then the whole filtering process eliminates the possibility of something that's timely, that's based on something that Romney said or that came into the news, in the last news cycle.
Right. I also think they were just looking for, like, things that were really hot-button issues for hardcore Republicans.
Yeah.
You know, like guns and everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, certainly. But what's so interesting is that they ask the Democrats, and in fact, try to pin them down. I mean, Hillary Clinton, the question about driver's license for illegal aliens, they ask the Democrats, the Republican talking point questions.
Yeah.
Rather than asking the Democrats the Democratic talking point questions.
That's a good point, yeah.
And whereas with the Republicans, they treat them with kid gloves. They don't ask them the questions that... that, frankly, most of America is concerned about, which are those Democratic talking point questions.
But I also get just frustrated when they don't call, like, Romney, them on assuming, like, with Guantanamo and everything, that if someone's accused of terrorism, then they're guilty and they're terrorists.
Right.
You know, we want them in Guantanamo because they attacked us. Well, what about, why are, just because someone's accused, why do you assume that they're guilty?
Yeah. Absolutely. And would you want that assumption to be made of you?
Right.
You know, should God forbid the day come. And that question is a question that Republicans just will not go near. And all the more the tragedy for the United States. Amy, thanks for the call. And you know, well said. Michael in Salem, Wisconsin. Hey, Michael.
Hi, how you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. I'm having a great time here in Los Angeles.
First-time caller.
Thank you.
I'm a first-time caller.
Well, thank you for calling.
Okay. I just want to make a statement. I told your other person these people that think they're Republicans, they think they're Republicans, they're not even a scratch on a pimple on a Republican butt. I don't know if I can say the other word, but
it's close enough. We get the metaphor.
Yeah, but if they got to blow, put their pants on and go to work every day, they aren't Republicans. They're confused.
Right. They don't realize that the real Republicans are the 0.3% of Americans who make more than $350,000 a year, or the 0.1% of the 1% of Americans who make more than the 1% of Americans who make more than about $500,000 a year, or the 0.1% of Americans who make, you know, well over $3 million a year.
Right. If
that's the real Republicans.
Some of your callers calling in are saying that, you know, they're Republicans. I don't believe it. I think they're just confused. If they keep saying to themselves, I'm confused, I'm not a Republican, maybe we'd win some of these elections and get it over with.
Well, we Democrats have to start talking like Democrats again. They have to go back to talking like Franklin Roosevelt did and calling these guys out and talking about corporate power. And frankly, the only guys who are doing this right now are Dennis Kucinich and John Edwards talking about corporate power in every single speech, and it never gets covered by the corporate powers. Gee, what a surprise. Leon in Seattle. Hey, Leon.
Yeah, hi. I was calling in. I wanted to respond to Paul Loeb, who was on just a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I'm calling from here in Seattle. I was involved in the 92 campaigns, the 94 campaigns, 96 campaigns. And the fact of the matter is, it's a lot of work to change. People forget how far out of power when it came to presidential elections Democrats were in 1992 and how much work it took to elect mm-hmm. Bill Clinton,
right.
And by the time 94 rolled around, I think a lot of people were just plain tired.
So you don't think that the base of the Democrats were put off by the fact that Clinton ran as a progressive and then governed as a Eisenhower Republican?
I really don't. Not that much. I think it just comes down to it's a lot of work to change things, and I think when you got, you know, I mean, and you've got to remember that the Democratic Party in this state was much weaker than it is now.
Yeah, well, that's true. Interesting perspective. Thank you, Leon, for sharing that with us. And thanks for getting out there and being active with the party. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
It just don't get any better. That's about as good ever gets. If there's anything better, it's something I missed. It just don't get any better than this.
Well, we can hope. 34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com. There's a new link there, so if you have an old bookmark, you might want to just go right over to TomHartman.com or to AirAmerica.com. Go to the Tom Hartman page, although I suspect that link hasn't been updated yet. It's probably pointing to the old page because we changed our website yesterday or reconfigured it somewhat considerably. So anyhow, check that out. Mike in Burbank, California. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Yeah, last night's debate, I felt that Mike Huckabee was cut a lot of slack when he
expressed a lot of humor about Jesus and religion, and I figured maybe that's because everybody knows that he's a minister, a religious man in his past. And I wanted to find out if the same type of slack would be granted Dennis Kucinich better than any other Democrat candidate because of his experience, his life experiences, and when he talks about the economy and how it affects the regular people.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who really can talk about poverty. He experienced it. Somehow I certainly the Republicans are not going to cut him that kind of slack. I mean, that but what I thought was interesting was that nobody apparently on that panel on the stage with Huckabee wanted to take on the issue of capital punishment, which means that all of the Republicans are gung-ho, you know, yeah, let's put people to death. And it's, I think it's a shame. It's a position I disagree with.
Save for Huckabee.
Huckabee's opposed to capital punishment?
No.
Yeah.
He's for it.
Yeah, that's my point. They were all in favor of capital punishment. And therefore, when he made a joke to deflect the question, who would Jesus execute? And the answer, obviously, to anybody who's, you know, read the Bible is nobody. And when he made a joke about it rather than answering the question directly, nobody stepped up and said, no, wait a minute, Mr. Huckabee, you're wrong. Capital punishment is wrong, which is what, you know, frankly, I think should have been done and should have been said. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. From Mike to Mike in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Mike.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Your book's on the top of my Christmas list.
Oh, well, good. Thank you.
Listen, I wanted to address a couple things. First off, the fellow that you had on earlier, Paul, and I didn't get his last name.
Paul Loeb.
Loeb?
Yeah, he's the author of some really quite world-changing books. The Impossible Will Take a Little Longer is one of his best. TheImpossible.org is his website.
Well, I appreciate his input. But, you know, what I've heard, and I just kind of keep it on the progressive station here in Eugene when I'm traveling around going to and from work and so on and so forth, and here in the office, and you know, there's been just a lot of Hillary bashing on the left side in the last week, and it's amazing. I mean, you can get it on the right side if you want to turn Rush on and the rest of those guys, but it seems like all the comments are negative on her, and she's splitting the party and so on and so forth. And what a great thing for the Republicans to have us do that.
Well, there is certainly an issue, an element of, you know, Democrats eating their own, and although the Republicans, I would argue, are doing the same thing. This is actually the first program segment, to the best of my knowledge, that I've ever done specifically criticizing any of the candidates, and in this case, specifically criticizing Hillary. I've always in the past taken the position, and I continue to take the position. This was Paul representing himself, not representing me. I've always taken the position that Hillary Clinton is a hell of a lot better than any of the Republicans, and that, frankly, I think that she could be pushed to become the next Franklin Roosevelt, because I think it's the times, not the candidate. I think that Franklin Roosevelt rose to the times. He didn't run on the campaign of the New Deal. Teddy Roosevelt didn't run on a campaign of the Square Deal. Abraham Lincoln didn't run on a campaign of reunifying America. Lyndon Johnson certainly did not run on a campaign of the Great Society and reducing poverty as he did so dramatically, and fighting racism in the United States. I mean, if anything, he had been, you know, one of the major proponents of you know, subtle, it's not, it wasn't so subtle, actually, of right-wing racism, largely in code, but, you know, from the South. All of these people became what they became because we got out there, because enough of us spoke out, because the times changed. And so I've said from the very beginning, and I'll say it again, if Hillary's the nominee of the party, I will vote for her, and I'll work to get her elected. That said, she's not my favorite candidate, but, you know, that said, I think that it is useful for us to have conversations about the various candidates and what their upsides and downsides might be. And you know, I frankly don't think it's going to hurt or wound Hillary or take her out of the, you know, it's this, the members of the base. I think that the Democratic activists and progressive activists who by and large make up the listenership of this program have long ago made up their minds about who their candidates are.
Well, you need somebody that has some empathy and some understanding of not only the people that she's going to represent, but the corporations that she's going to represent. And the other thing that happens is my company's a corporation, but I'm not considered a corporation compared to what's being talked about on the radio and the news. And I don't think it's really the corporation as much as it is the mega businesses that have control of us. You don't see anything on the evening news about any of the stuff that's going on in Iraq and so on and so forth that you think you should see, that Walter Cronkite or all the rest of those guys would have put on. But
about the only guy who's doing it is Keith Olbermann. And he doesn't have access to the footage because it just doesn't exist. It's not being fed by the networks. And, good point, Mike, and I appreciate your calling and making it. And let me just, add to Mike's comment about the corporations. This, from today's USA Today, the headline, the article by Greg Farrell, the headline, SEC, that's the Securities and Exchange Commission, limits investors' proxy power. Now, this goes to the point that I keep making, and that is that people think, for some reason, that corporations are democratic institutions because there are shareholders and they get to vote. But the shareholders don't vote on the behavior of the corporation. They vote on to some small extent they may be able to. But by and large, they vote on who are going to be the directors. And the directors hire the president and the senior officers, and then they run the company. Corporations are kingdoms. Labor unions are democracies. Everybody in the union actually votes for the president of the union. And at the local level, all the way up to the national level. Labor unions are democratic institutions. Government in the United States is a democratic institution. But corporations in the United States are kingdoms. I say that as somebody who has run corporations, who has owned corporations, and who is an observer of them. And here now, they're just getting flat out clear about it over at the Securities and Exchange Commission. There are three Republicans and one Democrat on the SEC. And in a 3-to-1 vote along party lines, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, reinforced its longstanding position that public firms can rebuff shareholders' attempts to get their own director candidates on proxy ballots. The Federal Appeals Court decision last year upended the SEC's position, creating the possibility that shareholder activists could force their candidates onto proxy slates through litigation, and the SEC said no. Basically, what they're saying is, we don't give a damn what the shareholders say. It's a kingdom. Annette Nazareth is the only Democrat on the SEC, and she said that today's amendments are an unfortunate step backward. That is to say the very least. I mean, that's very subtle. Mike in Los Angeles. Hey, Mike.
Hi. I think that the criticism towards Clinton isn't just limited to her. I think it's become clear to people that, we looked at the record of the Clintons, NAFTA get, welfare reform, cuts in domestic spending to get a budget surplus.
Telecommunications Act of 96.
Yeah, only to be blown away by Bush's deficits for his war. And they, a lot of people were left behind in the Clinton economy, and a lot of it was because of a technology explosion that really created a lot of jobs. And now what we have is a situation where, since Bush has been in office, Democrats have basically been a rubber stamp for everything they've done. Now that they've been put into power, they continue to be a rubber stamp. And, we don't want Bush versus Bush in the closet. It's back to what have you done for, what is your record? And the record is a do-nothing. And people in this last election, it took a lot of people showing up at the polls to put the Democrats in power. And I don't think they appreciate that.
Yeah. So your point that Hillary Clinton is a Republican light, in your opinion.
And it's not just Clinton the person or Clinton the family. It's the Democrats overall. They just think that the people who voted did anything to put them on a search and destroy to go after Bush and Cheney and really.
They didn't even do that. And Mike, thanks for your call. Bob, we got to move along here. Got to take a break. Bob in Columbia, South Carolina, about a minute to this break.
Well, I was just going to say, living in a place that is not as progressive as Seattle, where Mr. Loeb apparently is, I don't think that if Hillary Clinton were elected, that we would have an election in 2 years after that with everything going back to the Republicans. First of all, there's nobody like Newt Gingrich in the Congress today. Maybe somebody like Giuliani might be like him, but he's not in the Congress and doesn't have the base on which to lead such an insurrection. And I think it is in a part of the country where things are not as progressive as in others, any Democrat, Hillary Clinton or anyone else, would be such an improvement over what we have now and what we have had that they're not going to be thrown out in 2 years. I don't believe it, and I'm not even supporting
them. I'm inclined to agree with you, Bob, and the reason why I'm inclined to agree with you goes just one step beyond your logic, and that is that if we get a moderate, in quotes, Democrat in the White House, if Hillary Clinton is elected to president, I think that's frankly going to energize the Democratic base to try to move her to the left, to try and make her more progressive. And I think that that might be a good thing. 45 minutes past 8.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Every week on Thursday at this time, we're featuring one of our local sponsors, a local company that has gone to the trouble or made the effort to advertise on one of our local stations and find out a little bit about their company and also what kind of results they're getting. In part to say thank you and, you know, tip our hat to them, and in part to encourage others to do the same, and also to encourage you to support listener-supported Progressive Talk Radio by supporting our sponsors, which is how our listeners support these kind of programming. Paul Fridlin is with us, and Cynthia Fernandez. They are the co-owners of Pilgrim's Way Books in Carmel, California. Pilgrimsway.com, the website. And Paul and Cynthia, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. I had a great time at your bookstore.
We loved having you. You were such a gracious guest.
Well, thank you. You have an incredible, I mean, it's an absolutely incredible bookstore. It is, it's not just books. It's books and music and gargoyles, all kinds of cool stuff. I mean, it really embodies the essence, the really important quality of what a local business is and can be, particularly in the book business, and you're doing just great with it. Tell us about advertising on, I'm assuming it's KRXA that you're advertising on.
Yes, KRXA with Hal Ginsberg and company. They're just a great team of people who work together, as we do, to help build community and connect community with current issues and updates on them. And you know, the programming, Tom, is exceptional, and people have really learned that they don't want to miss a program. And as a result of that, in alignment with our mission to build community and be, a connection within whatever's going on in our area, we have really felt that people have gotten name recognition of our business. And that, as you know, is really important.
Yeah, so you're finding that you're advertising on, and KRXA is a very well-run radio station. Hal Ginsberg is a very smart programmer. He knows what he's doing. He's doing a great job. The website is KRXA540.com, by the way. And you're finding, Cynthia and Paul, that advertising Pilgrim's Way Bookstore on KRXA is helping your business more than it's costing for the ads.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, well, take a look at the incredible turnout for your talk, Tom, when you were here.
Yeah, you had to have two. We had to do two talks, in fact, because we sold out the first one.
That's a case in point. And when I introduced you and I thanked KRXA Radio, the audience definitely overwhelmingly
they went nuts.
Station. Yeah.
Yeah, they went nuts.
Yeah, they went nuts.
So have you tried other forms of advertising? Are there other things that have not worked as well compared to advertising on Progressive Talk Radio?
Yes, actually, we try to take a survey at the beginning of each of our events, and we advertise through the Monterey Herald, the Coast Weekly, local newspapers. We have handouts at the register of our calendar of events, and overwhelmingly, people hear it either by our email broadcast or KRXA.
Right.
And I have to say that is just huge. And we get accolades all the time from people. Thank you for supporting KRXA. They do such a great job in our community.
Amen. Well, Paul Fridlin and Cynthia Fernandez, pilgrimsway.com, the website for Pilgrim's Way Books in Carmel, California. Thank you both so much for being on the program today.
Thank you, Tom.
And for advertising on KRXA.
Okay.
Thank you. And all of you out there who are business owners, Progressive Talk Radio works. It really works. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Gene in Napa, California. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Oh, hi.
say, thanks for discussing this issue about Hillary. I think everybody's talking about it because there's an underlying thing that is disturbing, but I don't think people are getting to part of it. To start, I'd like to say I don't want to hear about a candidate's religious beliefs. I don't think that's necessary. But I insist that I hear about every candidate's position on theocracy. And I think a litmus test for that is the separation of church and state. And in one form that's happening now, breaking down, is turning over our government institutions to faith-based charities and giving them billions of dollars in government money.
Mm-hmm.
And Bush has been doing that, but the Clintons started it.
Yeah.
Now, there's an article in the October issue of Mother Jones titled Hillary's Prayer, and it's about Hillary's membership in a religious group called the Fellowship, and it gave a lot of disturbing data on this. The group's goal is to theocratize our government. And if Hillary doesn't want to talk about that in preparation for getting candidacy, I think that's unacceptable.
Yeah. Well, this brings us back to, you know, let's keep on and talk about the issues rather than somebody's race or gender or rather than somebody's personality or height or whatever. Let's stay with the issues. And the separation of church and state is a very real and very significant issue, Gene. And
theocracy is a threat to this country now with the underlying dominionist power, the dominionist pressure that's being placed on it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Gene, thank you very much for the call and for, you know, well said. John in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hey, John.
Oh, hey, man. Okay, I just want to touch briefly on the debate yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And how weird it was, how I think you did mention earlier that didn't really address anything. And I told the screener, I just wanted to say how much I hate Mitt Romney because he's just listen to a dude talk, it's like he's just pure politician. Everything that we don't want, which is just a dude that just looks good and says the right thing, I guess.
Right. He's the guy out of Central Casting. He's the Manchurian Candidate kind of candidate. The guy that, you know, just, you know, he was picked, you know, for his looks and his money. Actually, he picked himself. I mean, you know, he's largely funding his own campaign. And and you say, okay, where's the substance? Well, all the positions that he's holding, or most of the major positions that he's holding, Republican positions right now, are positions that he didn't hold 5-10 years ago. And he's saying, well, you know, trust me, I've changed. I was wrong back then. I'm right now. I don't think the Republicans are going to buy it. I just don't. Which leaves them with what? This is going to be an interesting campaign. This is good. We got an interesting year coming up here. 57 minutes past the hour. Stick around. We're going to talk about House Resolution 1954.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Well, and how democratic is democracy in the United States? And how much longer can we hold it together if we, the people, are potentially under assault from our own government? Odette Wilkins is with us. She's an attorney. She is a winner of the Project Censored Award this last year. In fact, that's where I met her. We were both on a panel together presenting at the award ceremony for Project Censored back about a month ago down in Modesto. She is the executive director of the Equal Justice Alliance, EqualJusticeAlliance.org, the website. And Odette, welcome to the program.
Great meeting you at Project Censored last month.
It was great meeting you, too. And you gave an absolutely startling, amazing, chilling, and shocking and brilliant presentation on the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And we had a fascinating conversation about House Resolution 1955, the Violent Radicalization Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007, and I wanted to get you on to talk about both of these things. As a lawyer and as the head of the Equal Justice Alliance, you have exhaustively studied both of these. And let's begin, if it's okay with you, with the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Give us give us the thumbnail on this.
Well, the thumbnail is that, and this is really streamlining and bottom lining the law, but if you interfere with an animal enterprise and you cause it profit loss, you could be prosecuted as a terrorist. Amazing as that may sound, but that's actually what it says.
So if I stand out in front of a McDonald's with a sign that says, don't eat McDonald's, don't eat, they're an animal operation, right, because they're serving animals?
Yeah, an animal enterprise is basically ubiquitous. It's any enterprise that sells or uses animals for a profit or sells, you know, animal parts. So that would include a supermarket. It would include a department store because they sell, you know, leather goods. It includes luncheonettes. It includes zoos, circuses. It includes, you know, it's really pretty ubiquitous and virtually includes every U.S. retail business in the United States.
Now, I assume this law was originally passed with an eye towards stopping people, the anti-vivisectionists, from disrupting laboratories where animal experimentation is done. Was that the original argument?
I think that the people the entities who were behind enacting the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act were the pharmaceutical companies, or a number of pharmaceutical companies. And certainly the ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is their lobbying group apparently, lobbied for this law, apparently on not just on the federal level, but on the state level.
Right.
And there are now, I believe, about 36 states that have ADA-type laws on the books.
ADA, the Animal Terrorism, Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, AETA, this is a federal law as well?
This is a federal law, yes. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is a federal law.
When was it signed into law?
It was signed into law in November of last year, actually.
So it was passed by Congress when it was under the control of Republicans?
Well, yes, but I have to say that it received tremendous bipartisan support, and it was really pushed by a number of Democrats. Dianne Feinstein was very much a proponent of it in the Senate, and Robert Scott, who is a Democrat from Virginia, was very much a proponent of it in the House. So this was very startling to find Democrats who you would otherwise think are stalwarts for and the first line of defense for defending civil liberties, really going and supporting this, and not just supporting it, but really pushing it for
Right. We're talking with Odette Wilkins. She's the executive director of the Equal Justice Alliance, equaljusticealliance.org, the website. Odette, if I cause a reduction in the profit of an animal enterprise, and that could be a posting on a blog that some store says we sold one less burger this week as a result of what this guy said. I mean, I'm a vegetarian. If I advocate vegetarianism on the radio, arguably every business in America that sells meat, or Dennis Kucinich arguing veganism, every business in America that sells leather shoes, could say that guy's a terrorist. What happens when I'm designated as a terrorist as a consequence of some kind of behavior that reduces the profit of a, quote, animal enterprise?
Well, it's, first of all, it's not really clear whether just having something on a blog is necessarily going to do that if you are talking about things generally. But certainly if you're outside, leafleting in front of McDonald's, or if you put on the blog, let's boycott McDonald's or whatever it is, then you're actually targeting a company, and to the extent that they have suffered any losses, technically the way the law is worded so broadly that it might conceivably, include an indictment for that kind of behavior.
By being designated as a terrorist, do I lose my rights to habeas corpus? Am I thrown into the Military Commissions Act, this third system of justice that has come into being in the United States? Could I end up in Guantanamo?
Well, I hope not, but certainly it's a little bit, from what I learned at Project Censored, I learned about the fact that the Military Commissions Act and the Defense Appropriations Act really allows the government to identify people as enemy combatants, whoever they feel are enemy combatants, and hopefully it won't come to doing that with animal activists. But
well, legally, what does it mean if you're defined as a terrorist?
Well, basically, it's really you used very loosely. But according to the Patriot Act, you really have to have there has to have been some kind of intimidation or coercion of a civilian population, or having or with the intent of influencing the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion.
Well, it's the Patriot Act, but the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act says that you're a terrorist if you pick up McDonald's.
Go ahead. That's right, and that's the conundrum, because basically, to be a terrorist, you will have had to, affect the government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. That's not what the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act says. I mean, basically, to really coin a term that a friend of mine has used, it's really nickel and diming activists that, if there's any kind of misdemeanor or violation, like some graffiti or some simple criminal trespass or something that actually is really just a violation or a misdemeanor, or you get a slap on the hand, or you would otherwise get 15 days in jail in state court.
Now
all of a sudden it's a terrorist act.
Well, yeah, my son and some friends of his, I shouldn't say it that way. I know of somebody who has a 12 or 13 year old, went through a local supermarket and put stickers on the meat that said this used to be somebody's baby. It's as a way of, being a, now that would designate somebody as a terrorist now under this law. And what I'm trying to get my hands around here, what I'm trying to get a sense of, or trying to see clearly, Odette, is if somebody is designated as a terrorist, how does that change their legal status with regard to our court system and the traditional freedoms that we think that we have and legal rights that we think that we have?
Well, usually, I'm not a criminal attorney, but certainly the system will hopefully, deem you innocent until proven guilty. However, in the court of public opinion, if you have already been charged or indicted as a terrorist under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, people are going to think that you are already a terrorist, even before you go to trial. And that's the problem. There's and if you're wrongfully arrested and it turns out that you're not convicted and you're exonerated, you will have spent a lot of money trying to defend yourself, and you will have, in the damage to your reputation is tremendous.
So this is more, it's like being labeled a child molester. I mean, this is more the kind of thing that the label itself does the damage as opposed to the legal status associated with it.
Well, yes, and because of that, you really touched on a very important point, Tom, because people are censoring themselves now. People are not really going out and demonstrating as much.
Because they're afraid of being charged as terrorists.
Well, yeah, because basically the vast majority of animal activists are really very law-abiding people. 99.999% are law-abiding. So no one wants to get in the crosshairs of the law, and they want to make sure that they're in compliance. So they're not going to want to do anything that might even have the taint
terrorism or something like that. We're talking with Odette Wilkins. She's the executive director of Equal Justice Alliance, equaljusticealliance.org. After the break, we'll talk about House Resolution 1955. Is that okay with you, Odette?
Great.
Great. We'll do it. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Well, I took a walk around the world to ease my troubled mind. I left my body lying somewhere in the fence time. But I watched the world go to the dark side of the moon. I feel there's nothing I can do. Yeah.
Oh, but there is. Inform yourself. Educate others. Get out there and get active. 21 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Odette Wilkins. She is the executive director of the Equal Justice Alliance, equaljusticealliance.org, the website. And Odette, on October 23rd, 2007, with 404 votes, the House of Representatives passed, with only six dissenting votes, passed the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2000, also known as House Resolution 1955. The Senate version, which has not yet passed the Senate, is Senate Bill 1959. Tell us about this.
You know, I'll tell you, Tom, I think it makes the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act look like an appetizer, frankly, because here we're actually looking at thought, and we're looking at criminalizing thought eventually, and ideology. And, you know, there's a lot in common with the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, because they are both targeting ideology that people think may be violent. But in terms of this Violent Radicalization Act, it really has a lot of undefined terms. You know, they really talk about extremist belief systems, but they don't say what is an extremist belief system or what's a violent radicalization belief system. And the commission that they are planning on putting together is on forming is going to have very broad investigative powers to examine and report on what they believe to be extremist belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
And
so,
that's very problematic.
Now the folks who say, oh, no, we're all just being hysterical, point out that this bill basically just creates a commission that reports back to Congress every 6 months for 18 months and holds hearings around the country to try and get some sense of why someone would become a terrorist inside the United States. What are the dissatisfactions out there and things like that? Isn't that a reasonable thing to do?
Well, on its face, it looks reasonable, but when you scratch beneath the surface, what does that actually entail? Who are they going to put on the list of entities or people or groups to examine? If they want to find out how particular groups are thinking, don't you think that they're going to be inviting them in to provide testimony? Perhaps they might even subpoena them. It really sounds like McCarthyism to me.
That's
what I meant to say. Thank you for correcting me. It could become something like that. It really reminds me of that era. And ultimately, if people are brought into the commission to testify, I think it creates the public perception that the people being investigated or being asked to testify are somehow engaging in violent or terrorist activities and are somehow disloyal, especially if they're expressing dissenting views to present government policy. And, Tom, you know that expression where there's smoke, there's fire? And people are going to think, well, why are they investigating these groups or these people? They must be doing something wrong.
Sure. At the same time, isn't it incumbent upon the government to have some sense of you know, what's going on, particularly with regard to groups like, you know, I keep thinking of Tim McVeigh. You know, what could have been done to prevent Tim McVeigh from doing what he did? What should we have known about that might have caused him to go down a different road?
Yeah, I think that that's a very fair question, and I think we should be doing some kind of research into what is giving rise to this, but ultimately, the purpose of this commission is also to provide recommendations for legislation for how to prevent and disrupt these kinds of ideological belief systems. But I'm afraid that this is going to go well beyond what is considered terrorism, because if history has been any lesson for us, if you go back to the 1960s and 70s with COINTELPRO, which was the FBI's counterintelligence program operations, you should read the congressional record on the scathing criticisms by Senator Sam Ervin and Senator Frank Church that basically handed their heads to them, because they were actually investigating people having no connection to any kind of violent ideology at all. They were just using those operations to track civil rights movement.
Right, I know. Odette, we have half a minute left.
Sure.
Do you know of any members of Congress who want to backtrack on this vote? Have any members come out and said, oops, we shouldn't have done that? And how do we stop this in the Senate?
I would say call up your senator immediately and tell them, you know, if you disagree with this, to that this is these are basically thought crimes, and that this is not really and that we should really be concentrating on going after people who are committing crimes, not people who have thoughts about or certain belief systems that have nothing to do with the crimes being committed.
Right. So we want to say vote no on Senate Bill 1959.
Right.
Senate resolution or whatever it's called. Yeah. And any members of the House come forward and say, oops?
You know, I really don't know. I haven't heard of anybody saying that, particularly with such an overwhelming vote. I think a lot of people are in favor of it.
I suspect that it's one of those things that nobody was really carefully analyzing, and so it just slipped through. It'd be interesting to, if a lot of our listeners were to contact their members of the House of Representatives and just say, why did you vote for H.R. 1955? I'd love to hear that feedback. Odette Wilkins. EqualJusticeAlliance.org. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome to the modern world. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio. Paul Waldman is with us. He is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, mediamatters.org, the website. His latest book is Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Successes. And this is our what's going on out there in the Internet's segment. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing, Tom?
Just great. Great to have you with us. What do you see over at Media Matters and looking at the media, you know, broadly, And in particular, actually, I'm curious if you have a take on any of the recent activities of the FCC. But what do you see broadly as the biggest stories of the day?
Well, obviously, everyone is focused on the presidential campaign. And that's as it should be, because after all, we're going to be picking our next leader. I think that, as usual, the coverage has left a lot to be desired. And I think in particular, what often happens is that the press focuses on the wrong things, and doesn't explore the questions that will really lead us to get a good understanding of who we might be voting for. We're seeing that, this year, no less than we have in past years. You know, after every election, there are always these forums take place at universities where reporters sit down and, you know, say, oh yes, you know, we really did a terrible job this time. We were focused on trivia. We didn't explore the important issues. We're going to do a better job next time. And then they never seem to. We have endless discussions about, whether, or not Hillary Clinton is cackling and, how much John Edwards paid for his haircut. Some of the more serious character issues that ought to be discussed really get missed. I mean, for instance, right now, I think the real character issue with Rudy Giuliani, for instance, the front-running Republican presidential candidate, is whether or not he has an honesty problem. He has been caught any number of times just basically lying about his opponents, lying about people on the Democratic side, and yet that's not part of the story that the press tells about him. Remember that was a story they told about Al Gore, but that's not the story they're telling about Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, and what's so bizarre is that, you know, Al Gore actually never said he invented the Internet. And you know, I mean, the honesty stuff about Al Gore, what Al Gore said was that he was proud to have co-sponsored the legislation that brought the Internet into being, which is true. And it's just what's so bizarre is that those were such small things compared to the Giuliani. And I mean, I remember when his second wife discovered, because she was being interviewed by, you know, with people with television cameras, that at that moment he was holding a press conference to announce he was divorcing her. And that's how she learned that she was being divorced. And, you know, this is. Right up there with Newt Gingrich telling his wife as she was coming out of the anesthesia from cancer surgery that he was divorcing her. I mean, it's truly bizarre. And they cut them all this slack on it. I don't get it, Paul.
Yeah, you're right, and that to I think any reasonable person suggests a level of sadism really that's pretty disturbing. And I'm not one of those people who says that the press should just focus on the issues and not talk about character when it comes to presidential candidates. I think character is important. The problem is that they always seem to focus on the wrong things when it comes to character. You know, their big question about George Bush, our current president, was whether or not he was stupid. And they didn't discuss the fact that he, during his first presidential campaign, showed a penchant for dishonesty, which we would later find manifest in the run-up to the war with Iraq. You know, Rudy Giuliani right now is offering a vision of foreign policy that I like to say is the Bush Doctrine, but without all the thoughtfulness and restraint. That's of a piece with those other parts of his character. So I think you can talk about all these things together without just repeating over and over again that he's America's mayor and the hero of 9/11.
Yeah, indeed. What are the stories that you're seeing that are not the big stories of the day that we should be attending to?
Well, you know, one thing having to do with Giuliani, since we're talking about him, that everybody missed over Thanksgiving holiday, the New York Times had a story about the latest piece of corruption having to do with Bernard Kerik, the man whom Giuliani not only rose up to be the police commissioner of New York, but also convinced George Bush to nominate for Secretary of Homeland Security, that Kerik apparently took a check for $250,000 from a Brooklyn marble salesman that turned out to have come from an Israeli billionaire who was also a defense contractor. When the investigators started to look into it, Kerik immediately cut a check to pay back the $250,000. That was a piece of that whole Kerik scandal and the different ways that he's has connections to the mafia and all these things that just sort of passed under the radar because it was Thanksgiving holiday. There are other media stories out there. Don Imus is probably coming back on the air, and that's something that most people haven't noticed. But I think the big question in terms of the presidential campaign, which we've been talking about, is: are the reporters going to be concentrating on those kinds of trivial things about what people's haircuts look like, whether Hillary Clinton showed cleavage when she gave a speech, whether Bill Clinton is having affairs? Is that what they're going to focus on, or are they going to give us a full picture that will allow the public to really make a smart and reasoned decision when it comes to Election Day?
Well, I think the simple answer is they're not going to. It's been pretty much the case. I mean, between the death of the Fairness Doctrine in 87, which had very little to do with balance and a lot to do with programming in the public interest, and the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which led to the death of a lot of local media in this country, what we have now is, I mean, I remember when CBS officially announced that their vice president of news was now reporting to the entertainment division, and that their news division was no longer a separate division, it was part of entertainment. And it was like a death in the family. I mean, for those of us who worked in news, I mean, I did news for 7 years back in the 1970s. There used to be an absolute firewall. And we all knew that firewall was there because that's what the radio station and television stations had to do to protect their license. They had to be sure that they were actually presenting news and informing people, because that was the largest of the community service that they did that was required under law. It's no longer the case.
No, and all that really, the changes happened in the 1980s and 1990s, when not only did our whole conception of what sort of obligations those broadcasters have to us as the public, the people whose airwaves they're using, that shifted. And, you know, we're talking about the television networks, all in the 1980s, all three of them were bought up by large, multinational conglomerates, right, where the pressure is always to increase profits and increase profits and increase profits.
Right. And this was part of Reagan's suspension of the Sherman Antitrust Act for all practical purposes, and the mergers and acquisition mania that followed, the Michael Milkins and whatnot, that led directly to this. I mean, I think that all of these guys should be subject to the Sherman Act. But anyway, you were in a mid sentence when I interrupted. I'm sorry.
No, that was what I was going to say is that we see when those big, especially publicly traded corporations, get a hold of news media properties, it's almost inevitably a decline in the quality of news people get. We've seen that in the newspaper industry, where you have these large publicly traded corporations where they are under pressure from Wall Street to increase profits and cut costs, And what usually happens in newspapers is that the newsrooms get gutted, and there's less investigative reporting, less of the kind of news that tells people what's really going on in their communities, and the news kind of gets homogenized and dumbed down, fewer and fewer reporters are there to report the news, and it really results in people in those communities being less informed.
We're talking with Paul Waldman. He's a senior fellow at Media Matters for America. His latest book, Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Successes, MediaMatters.org, of course, the website. Paul, one of the things that Media Matters does so well is it keeps track of right-wing spin, especially right-wing spin that is openly deceptive. What's at the top of Media Matters right now? What are the top issues that you guys are catching, or the top, the spin du jour, the spin du week? the Rileyisms and Limbaughisms and whatnot that are out there.
Well, we are obviously focusing a lot on the presidential campaign, and the other thing an issue that's coming up that has also to do with the campaign, but is out there a lot in other places, is immigration, which you're finding a kind of an increasing din on the right from people like Lou Dobbs on CNN, from people like Pat Buchanan, who has a new book out decrying immigration. We're really beginning to see kind of a ratcheting up of the ugliness and the xenophobia and sometimes outright racism that comes along with this, that's bubbling up a lot on the right wing, so we're keeping an eye on that.
Yeah, it seems relatively inevitable. Paul, thanks a lot for dropping by.
It's my pleasure.
Great talking with you. Paul Waldman, MediaMatters.org is the website, Media Matters for America, senior fellow over at Media Matters, and the author of just an absolutely great book, Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Need to Learn from Conservatives. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see here, Anna in Greeley, Colorado. Hey, Anna, I got about a half a minute before we got to take a break here. What's up?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to talk to you about this terrorism thing.
The Homegrown Terror Act.
Yeah, I always call. I called when they were voting in the past. Mm-hmm. I called he is really a dedicated Blue Dog Democrat, but I called him anyway and asked him not to vote for that, or asked the man who answered, and he said no. You just have to learn about what terrorism is. And I said, well, you know, the cops in Denver have a list that they got from the FBI after the FBI was busted the last time.
Mm-hmm.
And they came out and trained police forces all over to spy on people. And you know who was on there? AFSC, American Friends Service Committee.
Quakers. The Quakers.
Yeah.
The Quakers, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, they're definitely terrorists. We've known that for years. I can tell you, back in the 60s and 70s, during the Vietnam War, the Quakers were the terrorists, too. Anna, thank you very much for the call. You're so absolutely right. And this is it's anti-American. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Born in Connecticut with Texas draw. Lost half daddy's fortune and all. Thought they'd buy him a baseball team. And then figured that they'd make him king. But the first part of W is dub. Born with a silver foot in his mouth. Torturing the language, just trying to say ho. First part of W is dub.
First part of W is dub. Well, maybe. I frankly think that what's so dangerous about George Bush is he's not as dumb as we think he is. Welcome back. Ellen Ratner on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
That's for sure. Senator Leahy said that the president's non-involvement in the U.S. in attorney firings means that it does not count under executive privilege. And basically he said since the president was not involved in the firings of the U.S. attorneys, therefore Karl Rove and Josh Bolton and all those other people are not actually under executive privilege, and therefore they must comply. They have to testify, produce documents, etc. And, of course, the White House has claimed executive privilege. The White House today, through Dana Perino, said that they were baffled and that the White House and that Congress ought to spend more time on the agenda, such as the veterans, the mortgage crisis, and AMT. Very strange that they mentioned the mortgage crisis, because I hadn't known that the White House has done a whole heck of a lot on that one.
So basically they're saying, no droids in this car, move along.
Exactly. Exactly, exactly. Also,
are they going to get Ellen? Are they going to get away with it?
Unless you have a situation where Leahy really decides to make this a major issue, I think they may get away with it.
So
Leahy, the clock is running out. They only have a year.
Yeah, but if Leahy refers a contempt citation to the Senate, you know, A, what's the probability of it getting out of the Judiciary Committee, and B, what's the probability of the, and does it require a simple majority of the Senate or a supermajority of the Senate to pass something like that?
Well, I think it depends exactly. I'm not sure exactly what they would go in and what the contempt would be and what, I don't know the rules for how many they need. It will get out of committee would be my prediction because they have enough Democrats to get it out of committee. On another front, the White House today had a lower economic forecast for the year 2008, a GDP growth of 2.7 for next year. They said the unemployment rate would creep up to 4.9%. It's interesting, Dana Perino also said today that she felt the job growth was good, but they're going to have to weather the housing market. This at the same time, I don't know that she's aware that at the same time, the jobless claims went up 23,000 to 352,000, the highest since last February, in the last week.
Yeah, yeah. So the economic news is grim. And the White House is even acknowledging it.
But they're saying that they have a strong economic base. That's what the White House said today. And then at the same time, the numbers are coming out on joblessness going up. And, of course, this is the Christmas season when there's a lot of temporary and other kinds of jobs.
Yeah.
Thirdly, this is interesting in terms of the Democrats. As you know, John Dingell, a good Democrat, has been holding up the CAFE standards on the House Energy and Commerce Bill. And, of course, he's the chairman. And they are trying to come up with a Senate agreement and House agreement to increase the average CAFE standards from 25 miles per gallon to 35 miles by 2020. I mean, that is not exactly a huge increase.
No, not when you consider that the average car in Europe is pushing 40 miles per gallon. I mean, just the norm, it's in the high 30s.
Exactly. So we're not seeing a big help from the Democrats on that, and because he's a very powerful chairman, he can really control that. On another issue, the Kitty Hawk, a ship that I have been on right before the Iraq War, and my cousin Richard Miller wrote a book on it, on the Iraq War. The Kitty Hawk ship was supposed to find its way to Hong Kong, where a lot of the ship members' families were meeting them there for Thanksgiving. China turned it away. They also turned away two U.S. minesweepers that were seeking some kind of refuge in Hong Kong from a heavy storm. The White House is saying that the relationships with China are good, but that they want a hotline between the two militaries so that incidents like this don't happen.
Yes, yeah. I'm wondering, did the Chinese do this as a way of saying, take that for bringing the Dalai Lama into the White House?
Exactly. And the White House would not, that was asked this morning, and the White House would not say that it had anything to do with it except to say that relationships with China were good, that we work with them on so many things. Obviously, there's some big problems there. Another thing that happened yesterday, it happened 2 days ago, and I didn't get a chance to talk about it, but there was a talk at Georgetown University, and they were talking about a cyber war, and apparently the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he wasn't there, but he has released some statistics, James Cartwright said that there were 37,000 reported breaches of government and private computer systems in 2007. 13,000 direct assaults on federal agencies, and 80,000 attempted computer network attacks on the Defense Department military systems in 2007. They would not discuss who the specific enemies were or who's trying to hack into the government computers.
Well, I've seen news reports about a lot of this stuff coming from China.
Right. And, but again,
and out of the Chinese military. I mean, ISPs associated or DNSs or whatever the magic word is associated with the Chinese military. That's been in the press.
This is I understand, but what I'm saying is that they will not admit that. And again, this is the sort of we have friendly relationships.
Yeah, issue. Well, we like those toys they make that are lined with lead. You know, it's the date rape drug is a really cool stuff in those little toys. Yeah. Amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks a lot, Ellen, for the
Thank
for the
you.
Update. Good talking with you. Tonight, I'm doing the show here live from Los Angeles. Tonight, I'll be at Barnes & Noble, 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica, 7:30 p.m. So drop by if you're in the L.A. area. Tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls. Anything goes Friday. We'll also be live here from K-Talk tomorrow as well. Tomorrow night, I'll be speaking out at Oak Park, California Ventura County Democrat Speaker Series. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.